Tonight, the proper way to start this program would be with a record of Judy Garland singing on the Atchison, Topeka, and the Santa Fe. But I couldn't find that in our library. So instead, I just have to depend upon my own voice to introduce an old and cherished friend. Jim Lehrer is our guest. Yes, that Jim Lehrer, the one who does the nightly news, anchors the nightly news on PBS all over the country, and who has just committed his 20th novel, and it has everything to do with the Atchison, Topeka, and the Santa Fe.
Absolutely. Title is Super, as in Super Chief,
yeah,
which was the Santa Fe Railroad's premier streamliner train. They called it the Train of the Stars, Milt, because all the movie stars would ride that train. They'd get on in Los Angeles, they'd come to Chicago, they'd get off, go have lunch at the pump room, and they'd go to another train station here in Chicago. They'd get them in a Dearborn station. Then they'd either go to the Broadway Limited or the 20th Century Limited.
To go to New York.
Yeah. And the book is about a fictional kind of rough round trip. Rough meaning I have gotten the people off the train a little bit here and there, but basically it's one round trip in 1956, where I've got a lot of movie stars, and I've got Harry Truman, and I've got a paid killer and an unpaid killer and some bodies, and before it's over, Claudette Colbert joins the train, mm-hmm, and some people that I made up and all.
For
that.
Clark Gable is very
Clark
omnipresent.
Gable is there. Clark Gable is there.
And President Truman in his retirement.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And I have a character which you'll recognize. Everybody may not, but it's the son of a famous newspaper man who lived in Kansas, of course, William Allen White. Mm-hmm. I changed the name to somebody else. I mean, gave him a made-up name, but it's basically it's that character, based on that character.
And that connects back to the formation of your identity, I would think, since you were raised in Kansas. And probably when you were a kid, William Allen White was still a prevailing figure.
Absolutely right. The Sage of Emporia, they called him. And in those days, he had a huge connection to the Santa Fe Railroad, too. Those small newspaper editors were all bought and paid for by railroads. And mm-hmm, this would be a Union Pacific newspaper, and another one would be a Santa Fe or a Katy or whatever. And William Allen White's paper, the Emporia Gazette, was a, quote, Santa Fe newspaper. And as a result of that, whenever William Allen White, a member of his family, wanted to get on a Santa Fe train, they'd stop the train in Emporia for him, even mm-hmm, if they didn't normally stop
there. Yeah. The railroad, of course, is the key to the expansion of and the tying together of this vast country.
Absolutely right. Many of those towns in Kansas, Missouri, Oklahoma, all the way into Colorado, Arizona, named after various people who worked on railroads. The wife of a former CEO or somebody of a railroad, mm-hmm, the cousin of a chief passenger agent. You know, there are towns like Ada, Oklahoma, named after Ada, who was the wife of the then head of the Santa Fe Railroad.
Yeah.
There are all kinds of connections. And what, of course, the whole thing, as you say, it was all economic. They wanted to get immigrants to settle. Excuse me.
Have you ever heard of W.F. Bailey, who wrote a book titled The Story of the First Transcontinental Railroad? I don't know him, but here's an interesting quotation from him. He says, "The construction of the Union Pacific Railroad was of greater importance to the people of the United States than the inauguration of steamship service across the Atlantic or the laying of the Atlantic Telegraph. Yet the one has been heralded from time to time and the other allowed to sink into temporary obscurity." We didn't do proper justice or credit to the railroads, he says.
That's a very good point. We would never have moved, we meaning the Americans, American nation would never have moved west if it hadn't been for the railroads. There would be no Denver, Colorado. There would be no Wichita, Kansas. There would be no Kansas City. Might not even be with Chicago if it hadn't been there. As you know, Chicago
is the great hub.
Was the great hub of all. They all came in here. And there were, at one time, there were four or five train stations here. major train stations, and all the freight came in here.
Figuring very importantly in your novel, Super, is a station which still functions, as far as I know, namely the Dearborn Street Station.
Oh, exactly, exactly.
Yeah.
I went to, when I was working on the book, I went to the Dearborn Station building, which is looked from the outside, looks almost identical the way it looked when it mm-hmm. was a train station. Of course, now it's office building and all of that. But I spent some time, and it's not hard to imagine looking out certain windows and certain directions. It's not hard to imagine what it was like in Dearborn Station when the super chief and the other chiefs of the Santa Fe Railroad, they backed in there, because there was no track that went through the station. It just came to the station, so the trains would back up in there, and they would load, and you can hear the sounds and smell it all if you have a vivid imagination.
You know, your novel, Super, it takes place essentially on the train, on the journey from Chicago to Los Angeles. A number of quite surprising events occur.
Right.
There are a number of murders, or deaths at least.
Deaths.
What do you want to call them? Three of them.
Yep.
But it's in a genre which is very, very ancient, it seems to me.
Yeah.
One French literary critic once spoke of the novel, of assemblage, of assembly,
mm-hmm.
And points to things like the Decameron or the Canterbury Tales, a number of people thrown together.
That's right.
Now, in both of those, the Decameron and the Canterbury Tales, each of them ultimately tells a special story
exactly.
to entertain the others. But all the way on up to sort of almost the dawn of modern detective fiction, Murder on the Orient Express is a classic model for what you've got.
North by Northwest?
The film, yes.
But the exactly right. It is how many novels have been written, for instance, on ships where people came mm-hmm. together.
Ship of Fools
by
Catherine Ann Porter is a perfect
exactly,
case in point.
Perfect. And made into a good movie, too.
And hotels.
Yes, hotels, steamships. Trains,
yeah.
they're the classic. You can't hardly do that on an airplane, because you got to keep your seat.
I'm just asking myself, do you find anything comparable using the airliner as the setting? I don't think so.
No, there's only one movie, not a novel, but a movie where there was an overt act of sex on an airplane that was unheard of. And it was, I think, Jacqueline Bisset was in it, and everybody was stunned that it even occurred to anybody to do something like that on a cross country.
Well, in fact, it occurs to many people. I gather there's sort of an honorary club of people who've managed that in closeted
right?
bathrooms.
I wasn't
over
aware.
Kansas, yeah. Oh, yes. Yeah.
I wasn't aware of that.
There's a term for it. I forget what it is.
Yeah. But back to your point, I mean, it is one of the oldest and most used fictional devices there is to get a bunch of people in some place that they wouldn't otherwise be. And the more diverse the people, the better. And the more troubled the people, the better. And the more needy the people, the better. And all things can happen if you put your mind to it.
There's an old film, I believe John Barrymore is in it. It's a sound film, but back from the 30s, called, I think, 20th Century.
Yes, indeed. I watched that movie, yeah.
Yeah.
And the whole thing takes place on the 20th Century Limited.
Yeah. Is it going from New York to Chicago or
exactly.
vice versa?
New York. They're going from New York to Chicago.
Yeah.
And it's a crazy, wild movie. Because people don't know who John Barrymore is. You and I are the only two people left speaking, probably, who know who John Barrymore was.
I hope not.
I know. Well, we're among a small group.
He's the grandfather of that young actress who's something Barrymore.
Drew Barrymore. But John Barrymore was a comedian. He was a very funny actor.
Yes.
But later in life, he became, you know, the dramatic... Saturday Night Hero, Saturday Afternoon heartthrob actor, but in that movie he was terrific.
I think in that film he is somehow interacting with Carol Lombard.
Yes.
Do I have that right?
That's right. Carol Lombard.
She's a film star.
Yes.
In the movie.
Indeed. Yes. And Carol, she was the blonde siren type, as they call them.
And curiously, a central figure in your journey is her sometime husband, Clark Gable.
Right. Clark Gable. And Carol Lombard, to finish turning the curve here, or the circle, Carol Lombard, who was very active in World War II, collecting money for war bonds, was on a war bond drive, mm-hmm. and the plane crashed and she died.
Yeah.
And Clark Gable, who had been a flyer in World War II, did his best after that never to fly again. And that's why he was on the Super Chief all the time.
And that's real life.
That's real life.
Yeah, that's fascinating.
That's not made up life.
Yeah.
That's not made up life.
Fascinating. We continue on the journey from Chicago to L.A. on the Super Chief. April 1956, is that?
That's right. Absolutely.
Right after we pause for these words. And we return to Jim Lehrer. It's time to tell a little bit of the story. It's up to you to decide just how much of the story you want to tell, since it's a mystery novel.
Yeah.
But let's get on the train.
Okay. Well, that's the way to begin, then, would be at Dearborn Station.
Mm-hmm.
And it's early evening, and suddenly the PA system turns on. You hear this voice. May I have your attention, please? Passengers may now board through Track 7, Train 17, the Super Chief, the Atchison, Topeka, and the Santa Fe's. First class, all sleeping car, streamliner to Los Angeles. Making stops only in Fort Madison, Kansas City, Newton, Hutchinson, Dodge City, La Junta, Raton, Albuquerque, Gallup, Winslow, Flagstaff, Needles, Barstow, San Bernardino, Pasadena, and Union Station, Los Angeles. All aboard! Super Chief, Track 7, thank you for traveling the Santa Fe way.
Superb rendition.
Thank
Superb.
You. Thank you. Thank you.
Have you heard a recording of that, or are you just imagining?
No, I'm just now kind of, you know, I used to do a bus call. Remember all the time?
You're a great bus
How many
man.
Bus calls have I done on your program?
You've done them. And, of course, many of your novels have to do with buses.
Absolutely. But, see, I decided this is a skill set I have.
Yeah,
I might as well modify it to suit the new book. So, anyhow, the train, you hear that, and now the passengers like Clark Gable and other people have already been allowed on the train. They get to go on early because red caps take them and put them in their sleeping cars and they're sleeping in their compartments and all. They take them to the observation car, one of the bar. There were two or three bars on the train. And then other people get on, and then suddenly the adventure begins. And there are all kinds of, in terms of Clark Gable, one of the sleeping car porters who he knows very well. Everybody knows Clark Gable. Clark Gable provides him with all kinds of whiskey, all kinds of Kent cigarettes, and all kinds of women. And all of that began. He always eats the same food, and they bring it to him in the sleeping car, and his compartment, his bedroom. Now, this is the same is happening all over the train. The other passengers, too, are being taken care of that way. And the train gets to Kansas City. Now, the way those trains worked at that time, there would be a sleeping car at Union Station, Kansas City, that would be parked on a siding. And you could get on that train at 8 o'clock at night in Kansas City, go on to sleep. And then when the super chief came in, which would be about 2 in the morning, they would open a place in the train and slip in the train from Kansas City. And on this particular trip, Harry Truman is on that train because that's where he lived outside of.
Where's Harry going on this trip?
Harry's going to Los Angeles. He's going to make a speech, political speech, for a Democratic Party function.
Mm-hmm.
And he can't sleep. They leave Kansas City, and he wakes up. And he goes, he wants a drink. Well, Kansas is dry. And if you had a dry city, you weren't allowed to drink. Well, of course, it's also 2 or 3 in the morning, but he wanted a drink. So, anyhow, an exception was made by the Santa Fe.
Well, I would hope so.
Truman. Yes,
yeah.
Indeed.
So there must be some presidential privileges,
exactly.
even when you're a post-president.
You got it. So they took him, he went to the observation car where the bar was, and they poured him a drink. And lo and behold, train stops in a place called Emporia, where the train never stops. And Harry Truman doesn't know why, but then before you know it, as this man gets on with an old, well, not old then, but an old black royal typewriter, and he's got a monocle, and he smokes a cigarette with a cigarette holder and all of that, and he talks with a British accent. He's from Kansas, and he's the son of this famous newspaper man. But he's a war correspondent, had been a war correspondent himself. And, you know, they fall into talking. They get to be kind of friendly and all. And the train keeps moving. And other things happen. There's a man that suddenly, the train stops in Newton, which is a major Santa Fe division point. And lo and behold, the sleeping car porter opens the compartment where a man's supposed to be getting off. The man's a regular. He's a wealthy man, Newton, Kansas, a young man. But he's dead. He's got a gunshot in the middle of his chest. And so there's a police, a Santa Fe Railroad detective is already on the train to help Mr. Truman's thing. So he takes over the case. And there's an assistant passenger agent who is on the train also to kind of facilitate the Truman visit and take care of the movie stars. And the train keeps moving west, goes to Hutchinson, Dodge City. The guy, turns out, is hidden on the train. He wants to talk to Harry Truman about why he dropped the atomic bomb. And all kinds of things begin to happen, and people are thrown into various compartments, and there's great concern. And finally gets to Los Angeles. In Albuquerque, the train stops. In Albuquerque, the super chief always stopped at a certain time. They stopped for 15 minutes so you could buy Indian curios. And so the train keeps going. And it finally ends up in Los Angeles. And Truman gets off. The other people get off. But it turns out that a couple of those people need to go back, because there's one of those people on there that feels that he's in deep trouble, and he wants to die on the super chief. He always rode the super chief. Now he wants to die on the super
chief. Very rich man who comes aboard in a wheelchair, as I remember.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And then, it gets into Los Angeles at about 8 o'clock in the morning. At 4 o'clock in the afternoon, it starts back east. And a whole new set of adventures. Mm-hmm. Claudette Colbert is now on the train, as another famous movie star whose name I made up but is based on a real person. And there's another set of adventures happen, related only indirectly to the people that got off. And there's another death in a rather peculiar way that's drawn directly from a movie. An actor who played a part in a movie and committed murder is prompted to commit that same murder. They commit a second murder, a real one, using the same vehicle of murder that he did it's actually an actress who did it in the movie. So, you know, it gets very complicated. And for me, it is the best line, Milton, I'm the most proud of, is Claudette Colbert. It's 1 o'clock in the morning, and a train is about to come into Newton, Kansas on its second trip back, on its return visit. And this railroad guy is talking to Claudette Colbert. And she's very sophisticated. She's French. Mm-hmm. And he says something about Kansas. And he says, well, you know, you're in Kansas now, Ms. Colbert. And she said, young man, I am never in Kansas. My favorite line.
And it resonates to the famous Judy Garland line.
Exactly.
What was it, Coco? We're no longer in Kansas.
You're never in Kansas. Yeah, yeah, from... we'll think of it in a minute, but anyhow, eventually the train ends up in back where it started, in Dearborn Station, with all kinds of investigations going on. That and then there's I wrote a rather fulsome epilogue, and I'm not going to ruin it for anybody, but I tell you, Mel, it's interesting. Mm-hmm. The epilogue, a lot of people read that epilogue and think, oh, well, the story that Lair made up turns out to be true. Reading, of course, the epilogue was also part of the fiction.
Uh-huh.
But people want to believe everything.
Well, we've come to the moment of payoff, in which I am required to ask you, who done it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, Exactly, but see, I cannot answer that.
And like any good author of a mystery story, you can't tell me.
It remains to be seen.
This would be a natural for another major screenplay.
Yeah, it would be.
I wouldn't be at all surprised if that happens. Yeah, what do you think? Yeah.
Well, there's some interest in it. We'll see what happens.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, that and a nickel in the movie business. Yeah. The movie business, Milt, makes all businesses look absolutely squared away, absolutely mm-hmm. sane.
You mean it's that irrational and tempestuous?
Yeah.
And it's run by now by 24-year-old.
Oh, they're all exactly right.
Strangers.
And they only get to work in their jobs for about 3 weeks, and then they're fired. Because if they don't come up with a hit in 3 weeks, sorry, you know. Well, you know, we don't want to do murders anymore. Well, but you just asked me to do 15 murders. Well, we're sick of murders.
You've got one character in the book who is a once very successful and now essentially a disgraced movie producer.
That's right, and he's 40 years old and he's over the hill, and because he won't make television. He believes, and everybody else is making money. Doing television, and this is the beginning, you know, the mid-50s, late-50s, and television's taking over, and the movie business is hurting. You know, these things always go through. So, oh, my God, television's going to ruin the movie. It's just like television was going to ruin radio, and each thing comes along is going to ruin. We're in the middle of one of those things right now. Oh, my goodness, what's going to happen to the newspapers? Oh, my goodness, what's going to happen to network television?
Well, what is going to happen to the newspapers? We go from railroading to the news business in just a moment.
Okay.
Talking to Jim Lehrer, one of the central people in the American news business. But first, we pause for this. And we return to Jim Lehrer, whose 20th novel is the one we've been discussing, titled Super, or Super colon a novel. Before we talk about the news business, which I said we would do, let's talk a little bit about you and your strange novelistic proclivities. Strange only in that it seems a superhuman effort to do all that you do on your, quote, real job, and at the same time to turn out not only 20 novels, but all of them are wonderfully entertaining and really quite deftly wrought. We've talked about a number of them here.
Yeah.
You keep doing that. It's amazing.
Yeah. Well, you know, Milt, you know, we talked about this in rough terms before, but all we're talking about here is underlining something that is still part of who I am and what I do. Mm-hmm. And the bottom line is I'm one of those fortunate people in this world who made a decision when I was a kid, 16, 17 years old, that I wanted to do two things. I wanted to write made-up stories, and I wanted to write unmade-up stories. In other words, I wanted to be a novelist or a fiction writer, short story writer, and I also wanted to be a journalist. And here I am. And the blessing from that, I mean, there are very few people who made a decision when they were 16, 17 years old. And everything after that, with the exception, I was in the Marine Corps for 3 years, with the exception of those 3 years, after when I went to college, what I did was I worked for the high school newspaper, I mean the junior college newspaper, and I worked for high school newspaper, then junior college newspaper, and got a journalism degree after I got out of the junior college at the University of Missouri or in Columbia, and got a job. I was in the Marine Corps 3 years, then I got a job on a newspaper, and I've been doing journalism ever since. But I've also, at the same time, been doing the fiction writing. And what it is, Milt, is that it isn't that I write fiction in order to be released from all the heavy burdens of dealing with the great issues of our time. It isn't that at all. It is just requires now, it's a requirement for me to do both. It's such a blessing, and because I've been doing daily journalism as long as I have, I know how to go from a dead run to a dead run.
Let me ask you the Anthony Trollope question.
Sure.
You remember Anthony Trollope?
I do indeed.
In his memoir, reveals that he's a major figure in, I guess, the British Postal Service.
Exactly.
And he holds a bureaucratic position of some challenge and requiring a great deal of energy. But he gets up every morning at around 4 or 4:30 and sits down after a cup of tea, and it must be accompanied by a crumpet or something. But then he sits down and starts writing his novel.
Sure.
And the man produced about 50 novels, I think, in his total career. And he writes for 2 hours or so. If he finishes the novel After 1 hour and 45 minutes, he takes a deep breath, takes a clean sheet of paper, and starts the next novel. So he brags. Now, do you have a set time? Do you do this in the morning and home before you leave?
Well, it's a little. It's not as rigid as that, but for the news hour, our working editorial hours, we work on morning newspaper hours, meaning first editorial meeting 10 o'clock in the morning. Well, I go to the office at 8, and there's nobody there, so that's when I do my freshest writing, and that doesn't mean it's always new stuff. So that's when I do whatever, whether I'm editing, rewriting, doing some research, or whatever. But I do a little bit every day. The key to it is I do something every day that has to do with the book I'm working on, and I'm always working on a book. And I do exactly what Trollope does. When I have two or three working right now. I have a nonfiction book that I've just now finished, going to come out next year. The novel that is already set, set meaning that I've made a deal with Random House. They haven't seen it yet, but I've already done a first draft of the novel that will come out in 2012. And I've kind of sketched out, not an outline, but I've got an idea for the one after that. And I may, when I sometimes get a break on an airplane or whatever, I'll start writing about that. I have something going all the time. And I think I'm to a point now, it sounds kind of strange, but I think if I stopped, I'd have fidgets beyond normal fidgeting. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think I'd go nuts, and because it's a requirement of my life, and not a requirement in any kind of rigid way. It sounds obsessive, and maybe it is obsessive, but it's my comfort zone. It isn't I don't feel like it's a fidgety obsession. It just kind of float away and think about a train going through the Kansas Prairie in the 1950s, and then run a discussion or do an interview involving the Secretary of Defense, and then think again about, it's just the ability to do that. And I, after all these years, I can do it very comfortably, go from one to the other, and I'm blessed to be able to do that.
What do you do on your downtime when you're not working?
Downtime, my downtime I spend with my family. We have my wife Kate and I have three grown daughters. We have six grandchildren of all ages and descriptions and moods, and I love being with them. But I don't play golf. I don't play tennis. I don't do any of those things. I do exercise, a walk and an aqua jog. I do that sort of stuff. But I'm not we do some socializing. I enjoy being with friends. We're blessed by having really terrific friends. But I don't go to parties just to go to parties. I don't go to parties to work. Going to parties that is a work party for me is not a party. And so because I'm fortunate, I've been able to kind of eliminate the stuff in my life I don't want to do, so I can do the stuff I do want to do.
I've got about 4 minutes left. Forgive my doing the inevitable and the obvious, but I'm really interested in your response.
Sure.
You've been at that desk doing news on television and, of course, writing a great deal of news as well, or of commentary as well as the fiction. It's been a long time in Washington. How many years, in fact?
32 years.
Have you learned anything that stands out as your clue or your key to the nature of history or the nature of political process?
Probably the most important thing I've learned is that, for the most part, the people who serve the country and the government, elected, appointed, whatever, self-appointed even, are basically good people. They come for the right reasons. My friend and colleague Mark Shields says Washington is where all the high school student body presidents come. And most of the people are highly motivated. They care deeply about the country or issues or whatever. There are people who read. There are people who think. There are people who are articulate. And I've listened for all these 30 years, and people, complain about all these people in Washington, these awful people in Washington. And from some people's perspective, they may appear to be that. from my perspective, covering them as individuals, doesn't matter whether they're from the left or they're from the right, if they're Republicans or Democrats or whatever, most of them are driven by for reasons that that matter to them. Yes, some of them are corrupt. Yes, some of them are bought. Some of them waver from honesty of mind as well as goods and services. But for the most part, we are well served. That is the number one thing that that comes out to me. And in other words, the crooks are the exception. The poorly motivated are the exception. The power-driven are the exception. Most of these people come to serve rather than to exercise power.
I'll give you a small confession, just looking for your reaction to it. You and I are sort of the same age, even similar in some kinds of experience. As I grow older, and as I read history and observe the world around me, more and more I get the sense that it's Rosenberg's rule. Everything goes wrong. Sooner or later, everything goes wrong. With regard to human society, ours or anyone that one knows about, you get a sense of its radical imperfectibility, that nothing ever really holds and stably and effectively. There is no linear curve of ascent to the sunlit uplands.
Yeah.
What sense do you have of all of that?
Well, I agree with you there. I agree. But I think that decision was made for us back in 1776 by the folks who founded this country. They decided to have a country that was going to be messy.
Uh-huh.
It was going to be loud. It was going to be diverse. It was going to be the expressions were going to be were going to come at a not only a, at a loud pace but also kind of sharply. It's the idea that all the cliches are still true. It's a work in progress, and it's a kind of like a big rubber band. It just gives and gives and gives, and it contracts, and sometimes it goes off this way a little bit and off that way a little bit, and you have its bad times, you have its good times, but essentially the rubber band holds, and the rubber band is this wonderful creation that these people set up in 1776, and it's a glory to be part of it as an observer. And I've watched it stretch during Vietnam, during Watergate, during right now, with the financial crisis, with the Iraq War, with 9/11. But the rubber holds, and because it's spiritually driven, it's internally driven. It's driven by humanity. It's not driven by machines. It's not even driven by rules and regulations. It's because we make up the rules and the regulations, and we change them all the time. And it's a glorified mess.
You manage a little bit more optimism than I'm capable of, but that's part of your gift.
Right.
And I thank you so much for joining us again and for this fine new book, which I've enjoyed tremendously.
Thank you, Mel.
Super by Jim Lehrer, just published by
Random House.
By Random House.